KSDP 830 AM Sandpoint, K201DA King Cove, KFPS Falls Pass.
Many of them don't work at all. Many of them never showed up to work.
The Trump administration followed through with its plan to dismantle the Department of Education with layoffs across the agency.
Today is Wednesday, March 12th, and this is All Things Considered from NPR News.
I'm Juana Summers.
And I'm Mary Louise Kelly. The Trump administration is also taking steps to scale back vaccine-related research.
NPR has learned that the National Institutes of Health is now gathering information about research using the technology behind COVID vaccines.
If these cuts go through, this is going to have a profound impact on infectious disease research.
And 5 years later, we revisit club quarantine.
When the pandemic hit and the world shut down, DJ D-Nice brought thousands of people together online.
The music was secondary to what was actually happening there, and that was just connection for people.
After the news.
Live from NPR News in Washington, I'm Jack Spear. Iran's leadership is declining to hold new negotiations with the U.S. over a nuclear deal. NPR's Jackie Northam reports the announcement came after a letter from President Trump calling for new talks was delivered to Iran today.
The letter written by President Trump last week was delivered by a diplomat from the United Arab Emirates. Trump said he warned there are two ways to handle Iran, by military force or making a deal. Iran's supreme leader Ayatollah Ali Khamenei said the offer for talks was a lie and that they know the U.S. wouldn't honor any deal they make, so what's the point of negotiating? In 2018, Trump pulled out of an earlier nuclear deal that had been hammered out by world powers and then imposed stiff sanctions on the country. Since retaking office, Trump has reinstated the so-called maximum pressure campaign aimed at driving down Iran's oil exports and crippling its economy. Jackie Northam, NPR News.
The Trump administration's strategy of imposing tariffs on steel and aluminum imports has taken hold. In imposing the 25% tariffs on steel and aluminum coming into the U.S. from Europe and Canada, Trump vowing to take back wealth he says was, quote, stolen from other countries or by other countries. The tariffs drew quick retaliation from those countries. The administration today removed all exemptions from his 2018 tariffs on metals, in addition to raising tariffs on aluminum from 10 to 25%. 19 states and the District of Columbia made their case today that the Trump administration's mass firings of probationary federal workers is causing harm to state government. States are asking for a temporary restraining order. Scott Mascione from Member Station has more.
The states argued that the federal government conducted a reduction in force by firing 23,000 probationary workers from multiple agencies. Lawyers say the states were irreparably harmed by the layoffs because they legally have to provide benefits to the dismissed employees without warning from the federal government. The Trump administration says probationary workers can be fired based on performance reviews. Judge James Bedar seems skeptical that the administration conducted so many reviews in such a short period. He added that if the firings were part of a new policy, then the federal government would legally need to inform the states at least 60 days in advance. For NPR News, I'm Scott Mascione in Baltimore.
The government's main inflation gauge showed some signs of easing last month, though it remains above the Federal Reserve's 2% target. Labor Department says the price of a market basket of goods was up 2.8% last month. That's down from January's 3% rise. Core inflation, which strips out volatile food and energy prices, rose 3.1% in February, its lowest rise in nearly 4 years. The numbers were better than most economists had expected. Stocks recovered somewhat, fueled by those better-than-expected inflation figures. The S&P 500 was up 27 points. The NASDAQ rose 212 points today. The Dow was down 82 points. You're listening to NPR. The head of the Environmental Protection Agency is announcing plans to roll back environmental regulations, including rules on pollution from coal-fired power plants, climate change, and electric vehicles. The announcement coming from EPA Administrator Lee Zeldin, who says he believes the actions will eliminate trillions of dollars in regulatory costs and hidden taxes. Zeldin says rolling back regulations will make it less expensive to buy a car, heat a home, or operate a business. West Virginia Governor Patrick Morrisey held a ceremonial bill signing event today where he signed the Riley Gaines Act. As West Virginia Public Broadcasting's Brianna Heaney reports, the bill defines men and women by the sex they were assigned at birth.
Within one day of passing in the legislature, the Riley Gaines Act was on Governor Morrisey's desk.
The bill is critical for girls and women in our state, ensuring bathrooms and locker rooms are based on biological sex.
The bill makes it so trans people will still be legally considered the sex they were assigned at birth under state law. The legislation applies to trans people in state prisons and domestic violence shelters as well. The law is named after Riley Gaines, a political activist and former University of Kentucky swimmer, who tied for fifth place with a trans woman in an NCAA championship race. Opponents of the bill say it uses trans people as political targets. The law takes effect on June 10th. For NPR News, I'm Brianna Heaney in Charleston, West Virginia.
Crude oil futures prices moved higher today. Oil up $1.43 a barrel to settle at $67.68 a barrel in New York. I'm Jack Spear, NPR News in Washington.
Support for NPR comes from NPR stations. Other contributors include Lilly Endowment, a private foundation supporting NPR's coverage of religion and spirituality, and Jarl and Pamela Mohn, focusing on civil liberties, foster youth, public radio, and the arts.
This is All Things Considered from NPR News. I'm Juana Summers.
And I'm Mary Louise Kelly. We begin this hour with the latest on the Trump administration's efforts to dismantle the U.S. Department of Education. Late yesterday, the administration announced sweeping layoffs. Between those cuts and the hundreds of veteran staffers who have agreed to leave voluntarily, the Education Department will soon be roughly half the size it was 2 months ago, cut from around 4,100 to around 2,200. For more on those cuts and how they may play out across the country, let's bring in NPR's Corey Turner. Hey there.
Hey, Mary Louise.
Who are the workers losing their jobs?
While just about every office in the department lost staff, I think it's important right now to focus on the handful of offices that were hit especially hard. One of them is the Office for Civil Rights. These are largely attorneys. They're based all over the country, and they field complaints from families and parents who say, hey, a school discriminated against my child because of their race, sex, or disability. Now, according to internal department data obtained by NPR, at least 240 employees in the Office for Civil Rights were laid off, most of them attorneys. I spoke earlier today with Catherine Lehman. She ran the Office for Civil Rights under both the Obama and Biden administrations, and she called these cuts devastating.
Cutting the office by more than half is an absolute walk away from our longstanding bipartisan commitments to civil rights and our belief that every one of our kids is a valuable learner.
It's also worth pointing out, Mary Louise, the Trump administration has said it wants to crack down on campus anti-Semitism, but to do that now at these staffing levels, it will almost certainly require deprioritizing some other discrimination claims.
Another thing to ask you about, Corey, the federal dollars that schools get from the Education Department, which specifically help kids in low-income communities, also kids with disabilities.
Yeah, so that money provided by law will still flow to schools, but several sources told me the administration has fired most of the experts who help states and school districts understand how they can and cannot spend that money. So these are also the attorneys who say, hey, you're breaking the law. Don't do that, or you could lose your federal funding. You know, these layoffs essentially allow states to keep receiving federal funds while limiting the U.S. government's ability to offer guidance or guardrails to guarantee that this money is being used to help the kids it was meant to help.
Well, what are the people making these cuts, either at the Ed Department or at the White House? What are they saying in their defense?
So President Trump himself was asked about them earlier today. He said a few things. One, he repeated something he has said many times now, that he wants to return education to the states. This is a big Republican talking point. He called it a dream of his. He also said this.
When we cut, we want to cut, but we want to cut the people that aren't working or not doing a good job. We're keeping the best people.
The problem with that, Mary Louise, is I am right now looking at a spreadsheet of nearly 1,000 Education Department employees who were fired and the jobs they did. And these layoffs were the opposite of a thoughtful case-by-case, person-by-person thinning based on past performance. They cut people in large groups with nothing in common but the kind of work that they were doing. Again, civil rights enforcement, education research. I spoke with one person in the student loans office. They told me through these cuts and buyouts, the Office of Federal Student Aid has lost many of its best and most productive people.
A basic question, Corey. Are these cuts legal?
We don't know, Mary Louise. That is the question. I have spoken with several government and legal experts who say they certainly push at the edges of what's legal, because the law is pretty clear that only Congress has the power to eliminate programs it created. But then is cutting department staff in half tantamount to eliminating programs? I think lawsuits are inevitable. The courts could step in. But what comes of all this? I have no idea.
And NPR's Corey Turner. Thanks, Corey.
You're welcome.
The technology behind the COVID-19 vaccines is under scrutiny. The National Institutes of Health is looking into agency-funded research of the cutting-edge technology NPR has found, and this could be a prelude to funding cuts. The move comes after the Trump administration has taken other steps to scale back vaccine research. NPR health correspondent Rob Stein joins us now. Hey, Rob.
Hey, Juana.
So, Rob, with Robert F. Kennedy Jr. taking over at the Department of Health and Human Services, there have been a number of questions about how his past anti-vaccine advocacy could affect federal health agencies. What is the latest at NIH?
NPR has reviewed internal NIH documents from an employee who wasn't authorized to share them that show officials are seeking information about funding of so-called mRNA technology. That's the foundation of the Moderna and Pfizer-BioNTech COVID vaccines. The acting NIH director last week requested a full accounting of all vaccine research involving mRNA technology that the agency funds, and has collected information about at least 130 grants from the National Institute of Allergy Infectious Diseases alone. These are grants to scientists around the country who are studying mRNA technology to develop vaccines for a variety of diseases, including COVID, but also malaria, Lyme disease, and a sometimes deadly gastrointestinal bug.
Any indication why the NIH is doing this?
You know, we really don't. We asked both the NIH and the Department of Health and Human Services for comment, but haven't heard anything back. But remember, mRNA technology was used by President Trump's Operation Warp Speed to quickly create the first COVID vaccines. Others that came later used more conventional methods. The mRNA vaccines are considered a scientific triumph, but they became a lightning rod for criticism because of vaccine mandates. They were also embroiled in misinformation, such as, you know, false claims that they're unsafer, could even modify a person's DNA. So this call for information is seen as ominous both inside and outside the NIH. I talked about this with Justin Richner. He's at the University of Chicago, University of Illinois Chicago. He has a $1 million four-year grant from the NIH to develop an mRNA vaccine against dengue. That's a nasty mosquito-borne disease that affects millions of people around the world and is spreading in the U.S.
I am on pins and needles constantly. I'm really kind of waiting for the shoe to drop in terms of looking for the email saying the grant has been canceled. It is very concerning that they're going after this type of research. To shut down research entirely is really short-sighted and misguided. If these cuts go through, this is going to have a profound impact on infectious disease research.
Richner stresses that mRNA vaccines have been given to millions of people around the world and are very safe and effective. But I should point out that HHS is also reviewing a contract to develop an mRNA vaccine against the bird flu, which is spreading among poultry and dairy cows, raising fears it could spark another pandemic.
Rob, as I understand it, these are not the only recent NIH moves related to vaccines, correct?
That's right. That's right. NPR has also seen internal NIH emails about studies the agency is funding to understand vaccine hesitancy and uptake. You know, why parents and others are hesitant to get themselves or their kids vaccinated. That's a big growing problem, especially in the wake of the pandemic, and especially now with the measles making a comeback. According to an NIH employee who did not want to be identified because they were not authorized to speak publicly, 42 grants to study vaccine hesitancy and uptake have already been terminated, and those terminations came after the same kind of call for information we're seeing now for the mRNA vaccine research.
Are there other areas where the NIH is cutting grants?
Yes, absolutely. As my colleague Will Stone has found, the NIH has also terminated some research on LGBTQ and other vulnerable groups with health disparities to comply with the president's executive orders related to gender and diversity, equity, and inclusion.
That's NPR health correspondent Rob Stein. Thank you.
You bet.
Last year, Salt Lake City won the bid to host the Winter Olympics in 2034. Now, state leaders are trying to have electric air taxis operating in time for the Games. KUER's Caroline Ballard reports.
The small white Alia aircraft buzzes down the runway and lifts into the sky above Utah's snow-capped mountains. It looks similar to any other small plane overhead. It's designed to carry up to 5 passengers, and it is entirely electric. Emma Davis, a flight test engineer at Vermont-based aerospace company Beta Technologies that makes the Alia, really enjoys flying in them.
So the coolest thing about this aircraft is the view. You'll notice that the windscreen is basically uninterrupted. It's just, it's beautiful, it's breathtaking, and it's exciting just to be able to fly in a piece of, you know, future history.
Back in October, the Federal Aviation Administration recognized electric air taxis as a new type of aircraft, joining helicopters and airplanes. It also outlined training and regulations for pilots to fly them. But there's still a long process before air taxi companies can start operating. State Senator Wayne Harper has worked for years to clear the way for that to happen in Utah. He says companies have told him there are no remaining barriers from the state.
All the companies say, nope, the barriers are out of the way. The only challenge we have is make sure we get FAA certification and we can have airspace that we can fly in.
But with all the policy changes under the Trump administration, there's no firm timeline for when licensed air taxi pilots will take to the skies. On Monday, the FAA said it would temporarily suspend its new air taxi rule while the administration reviews it. Still, Matthew Moss, the Utah Department of Transportation's director of aeronautics, is confident an Uber-in-the-sky type service will be available in time for the 2034 Olympics. But he says it might not look like science fiction just yet.
You know, you think of Blade Runner or something futuristic, you know, Star Wars, all these vehicles that are flying in the sky. 100 years, 200 years, maybe it'll look like that, but it's not going to be anything like that in the near term.
Beta Technologies and Utah's Aerospace and Defense Trade Group are showing off the Alia aircraft at Utah airports this week. For NPR News, I'm Caroline Ballard in Salt Lake City.
You're listening to All Things Considered from NPR News.
Support for NPR comes from the station. And from Fisher Investments. Fisher's dedicated team of specialists provide resources on investing, retirement income, estate planning, and more. Learn more at fisherinvestments.com. Investing in securities involves the risk of loss. From Procter & Gamble, maker of Metamucil psyllium fiber supplements to support daily digestive health by trapping and removing waste. Learn more at metamucil.com. And from listeners like you who donate to this NPR station.
From NPR News, this is All Things Considered. I'm Juana Summers.
And I'm Mary Louise Kelly. NASA is set to launch a crew of four there on a SpaceX capsule launching from Kennedy Space Center in Florida to the International Space Station. Now, this marks the last major step in the plan to bring home two other astronauts who have been at the station since last June. Central Florida Public Media's Brendan Byrne is here to tell us more about the mission. Hey there, Brendan.
Hi, Mary Louise.
Can I start by just asking about these two astronauts who have been up there since last summer and are looking finally to come home?
Sure. They're NASA's Butch Wilmore and Sonny Williams. They flew to the space station back in June on Boeing's Starliner capsule. It was a test mission, the first time the capsule was carrying astronauts, and only scheduled for about 8 days. But engineers at NASA and Boeing uncovered issues with the vehicle after its arrival. Leadership at NASA decided to return the capsule home without Wilmore and Williams and instead rely on another commercial partner, SpaceX, to bring them home. In the meantime, Wilmore and Williams have joined the crew of the station, performing science, conducting spacewalks, and even helping with some tech support on the station's laptops.
And I just said this is the last major step in the plan to bring them back to Earth. There must have been quite a saga since they were supposed to be up there 8 days, and they've been there since last summer. Just explain more what that means.
Yeah, so they arrived back in June. Then NASA launched Crew 9 back in September with only two people and two empty seats, with the plan to bring Wilmore and Williams home when that mission was over. That is now coming to a close as the next station crew, Crew 10, arrives. And NASA says within a week or so, Wilmore and Williams will join the two Crew 9 astronauts in that SpaceX capsule and come home, splashing down off the coast of Florida.
And this is the mission that has gotten caught up in politics as well. Explain.
Yeah, that's right. President Donald Trump and his close advisor and the head of SpaceX, Elon Musk, have suggested that then-President Biden's administration left Williams and Wilmore in space for political reasons. There's no evidence to suggest that that is true at all. In fact, this plan was devised during the Biden administration. The decision was made last August. NASA administrators were very clear that safety was the biggest issue. This is an agency that has had tragedy with space shuttle accidents, 1986 and 2003. Those have shaped the way they approach astronaut safety. And astronauts are prepared for those risks and changes to the plan. While this was initially a short-term mission for Wilmore and Williams, they trained to be in orbit for much longer. Nicole Ayers is the pilot of the mission that will relieve the crew, and she puts it this way in a press conference this week.
We are prepared for almost anything here at NASA. That's one of our strengths. We're always ready with a backup plan.
And has either she, Brendan, or other members of this incoming crew, have they been in touch with Williams and Wilmore ahead of arrival?
Yeah, in fact, they have. Commander Anne McLean says they've spoken several times during their extended stay and the launch delays leading up to this.
They really are in good spirits. Of course, they're ready to come home, and of course, we're ready to launch. But the most important thing is that we do both of those things safely. All of us take very serious our responsibility to be stewards of the International Space Station.
Stewards of the International Space Station. That's such a lovely way of thinking about it. So just tell me more about what this incoming mission, what they are going to be doing.
Sure. Their mission's a pretty routine ISS mission. The crew's made up of two U.S. astronauts, an astronaut from Japan, and a Russian cosmonaut. They'll conduct hundreds of science experiments, perform maintenance on the station, living and working on the ISS for about a year and a half, and they'll continue the more than two decades of continued human presence in low Earth orbit.
Brendan Byrne, reporter with Central Florida Public Media, also host of the Space Exploration podcast, Are We There Yet? Brendan, thank you.
Thanks, Mary Louise.
Now
The U.S. government wants to deport Mahmoud Khalil. He's the Palestinian activist and Columbia University graduate student that it accuses of supporting Hamas terrorism. After arresting him in New York over the weekend, Immigration and Customs Enforcement sent him to a detention center in Louisiana. In federal court in Manhattan today, his lawyers tried to convince a judge to order ICE to return him to New York. NPR's Adrian Florido was in the courtroom and joins me now. Hi there.
Hi, Juana.
So, Adrian, before you tell us what all happened in court today, could you just start by reminding us of the details of Khalil's arrest?
Well, he was arrested on Saturday by ICE agents who showed up at his Columbia University-owned apartment and said his green card had been revoked. Khalil has been a visible leader of pro-Palestinian activism at Columbia. After he was picked up, President Trump said it was because he supports Hamas terrorism against Israel. Khalil's lawyers reject that. They say he is a loving student leader, a soon-to-be father, who wants peace for Palestinians. I should say, Juana, that the specifics of the government's charges against him aren't yet clear.
Got it. Okay, so what did the lawyers on both sides have to say in federal court today?
Well, Khalil's lawyers accused the government of quickly shipping him off to a detention center in Louisiana in order to make it harder for them to challenge the government's attempts to deport him. And they said that as of this morning, they still had not been allowed a private phone call with Khalil, though the judge ordered that they be allowed to speak with him today. His lawyers filed a petition asking that ICE bring him back to New York, but the government does not want to do that. And a government lawyer told federal judge Jesse Furman today that the government would provide its reasons by Friday. The judge is likely to decide on this sometime next week.
You said the government doesn't want to send him back. Why is that?
We don't know for sure. What we do know is that federal and appellate courts in Louisiana tend to be more conservative-leaning than the courts in New York, where his lawyers want the case heard.
So it sounds like more of a procedural hearing today than one dealing with the more substantive questions in this case. One of those, of course, being, should the government be allowed to strip someone's green card and then deport them because of their activism?
Yeah, once the venue issues are resolved, that is a question that the court will address. And Judge Furman more than once acknowledged today that this is a case that raises really weighty issues. Khalil's lawyers, after the hearing, they really did set their focus on these larger questions. Listen to what one of his attorneys, Bahir Azmi of the Center for Constitutional Rights, said from the courthouse steps while a large crowd of Khalil's supporters listened from a plaza across the street.
Mr. Khalil's detention has nothing to do with security. It is only about repression. The United States government has taken the position that it can arrest, detain, and seek to deport a lawful permanent resident exclusively because of his peaceful, constitutionally protected activism.
Adrian, what does the government say about its authority to arrest someone like Mahmoud Khalil and then to try to strip their legal permanent residency?
Well, this is exactly what President Trump has said he's going to do, deport non-citizens who've participated in his words, pro-jihadist protests. The government has cited an immigration code that gives the Secretary of State the power to deport someone whose activities, the top diplomat finds, could have harmful foreign policy consequences for the U.S. Speaking to reporters today, Secretary of State Marco Rubio said this case is not about free speech at all. He said, quote, "This is about people that don't have a right to be in the United States to begin with." It's going to be very interesting, Juana, to see what evidence the government brings in its attempt to prove the assertion that Mahmoud Khalil is a threat.
I've been speaking with NPR's Adrian Florido, who is at federal court in Manhattan today. Thank you, Adrian.
Thank you, Juana.
You're listening to All Things Considered.
5 years ago this week, COVID-19 was declared a pandemic. Now, while it revealed problems in how health authorities respond to infectious disease outbreaks,
they've made huge improvements in their ability to see what's happening here in the United States.
In some ways, pandemic preparedness has also gotten worse. That's tomorrow on Morning Edition from NPR News.
All Things Considered. From NPR News, I'm Juana Summers.
And I'm Mary Louise Kelly. NASA is launching a crew of 4 astronauts to the International Space Station.
Their arrival will clear the way for 2 astronauts who went up last June to finally return to Earth.
We are prepared for almost anything here at NASA. That's one of our strengths. We're always ready with a backup plan.
First, the news.
Live from NPR News in Culver City, California, I'm Dwayne Brown. The Trump administration plans to cut the jobs of nearly half of the Department of Education in its effort to streamline the federal agency from about 4,100 staffers down to 2,200. The administration claims that critical programs like Pell Grants and student loans would not be affected, but educators say the cuts will mean less resources and much larger class sizes. Becky Pringle is president of the National Education Association. She says every state will be impacted.
We are already seeing funding levels being proposed that will not be able to meet the needs of students. That will slash those over 400,000 jobs that the federal government, education jobs, that the federal government pays for in communities all over this country. Every single state will be impacted by these cuts.
The White House has halted much of the government's adoption of electric vehicles into its massive fleet of cars and trucks. Nathaniel Miner has the story.
The U.S. General Services Administration orders many of the vehicles and owns many of the EV chargers used by other federal agencies. Recent memos show it has suspended orders of zero-emission vehicles, stopped the installation of new EV charging stations, and even ordered some existing stations to be shut down. That adds up to a big reversal from the Biden administration, which had pushed hard to add more EVs into the federal fleet as part of its efforts to combat climate change and support the EV industry. For NPR News, I'm Nathaniel Miner in Denver.
Hydraulic system issues forced SpaceX to scrub its flight this evening to bring home 2 stranded NASA astronauts. The next attempt could come as early as tomorrow. The pair were supposed to be in space for a week, but have spent 9 months in orbit. This is NPR News. Egg prices continue to rise across the country, up more than 10% last month from the Gulf States newsroom. Stephen Bisaha reports on why egg inflation is worse in the South.
The avian flu is the main reason egg prices have nearly doubled nationally. And in the South, they've more than doubled. Even during normal times, many southern states have an egg deficit. The high temperatures here lend themselves better for raising chickens for meat, not for laying eggs. That's according to Ray Hilburn with the Alabama Poultry and Egg Association.
You know, one thing we love to do in Alabama is eat desserts. So therefore, we having to truck in about 6.5 million eggs per day.
And those trucking costs from states like Iowa get tacked onto egg prices. Overall inflation in the country rose 2.8% year over year in February. For NPR News, I'm Stephen Bisaha in Birmingham, Alabama.
Artificial intelligence has made its way to the wine industry, where some businesses are using it to supplement labor without displacing workers. Farmers are using new agricultural tech like AI to reduce waste and monitor where and when to use products like fertilizer or pest control. As AI continues to grow, it's also providing farmers more accurate data on the health of a crop or what a season's yield will ultimately be. Stocks finished mixed on Wall Street today as inflation slowed for the first time since September. This is NPR.
Support for NPR comes from the station and from Bank of America, From local shops to global enterprises, Bank of America is committed to helping businesses of all sizes make every move matter. Learn more at bankofamerica.com/bankingforbusiness. From Indeed, committed to giving job listings increased visibility with relevant candidates through its sponsored jobs feature. Learn more at indeed.com/NPR. And from the John D. and Catherine T. MacArthur Foundation at macfound.org.
This is All Things Considered from NPR News. I'm Mary Louise Kelly.
And I'm Juana Summers. The coronavirus pandemic changed everything. It forced music venues to shut their doors and concert halls to go silent. Hearing our favorite songs in person seemed like a thing of the past. But Derek Jones, known by his stage name DJ D-Nice, brought the party to us in our homes.
Welcome to homeschool. It's plus 14.
His club quarantine dance parties on Instagram Live attracted hundreds of thousands of locked-in music lovers, from First Lady Michelle Obama and Senator Cory Booker to Quincy Jones.
Quincy Jones is in here. Let's take it back. What's up, Gil King?
Now, DJ D-Nice did not come out of nowhere. He was a prominent hip-hop artist and producer in the 80s as part of the group Boogie Down Productions.
And then I fell in love with DJing around 2004. I fell in love with just the feeling of being able to play music from different genres, from different eras. But it was more in the like kind of local New York club scene.
He decided to move to LA from New York in 2019. Then COVID happened.
When the pandemic hit, I was quarantined alone. And what's interesting is, had I been in New York, then none of this happens, because I would have been quarantined with my family, or, you know, quarantined with friends, whatever it was.
He's kept the party going, doing live in-person events at places like the Kennedy Center. There is even a documentary in the works. I caught up with DJ D-Nice earlier this week to talk about club quarantine 5 years later.
Oh my God, this is so great. We got the biggest party going on in the world right now.
Saturday night, the 21st of March, was literally the big night, because that's when the world started to pay attention. But the night before was important, though, because, you know, I'm not friends with The Rock. He wasn't even following me, or, you know, I met Drake one time or whatever, you know, like I know J-Lo, but not like that, you know. And it was to have this kind of virtual party where those three specific people were in there listening. And I remember people feeling like, wow, like this is beautiful. The only people missing are the Obamas. I remember that comment. And the next day it was, you know, which was the big night when everyone showed up, from Oprah to Michelle, you know, Gail King, you know, Ellen DeGeneres.
Ellen, are you dancing right now? Ellen, are you dancing? Let's dance, Ellen.
It became this thing where you could feel the love in that virtual space. Most of those people I've either played for, you know, did a private event for, which is why I was on their radar. That Saturday night when the world found out, I was just asking for favors, like, hey, can this person stop in?
100,000 people, let's go.
I'll be honest with you, like, to know that those phone calls with me just asking turned into people reaching out to even bigger celebs to say, hey, come in here, this is incredible. You know, it will always be like one of the highlights of my career. And, you know, I know for sure that we mattered to people back then.
I know what the space that you created online did for so many of us who were fearful, who were home alone or with just a couple of people who were in their sort of quarantine bubble, who were seeking answers, but more, perhaps even more importantly, seeking connection. But I want to know, what did that do for you? As you mentioned, you were there in Los Angeles when all of this was happening. You were not with your family. You were quarantining alone. And yet you convened all these people together. What did it mean for you personally?
Personally, I knew what it was doing for people. I could have been selfish. You know, I had a flight that Friday, I had a flight to go to be with my family. But I saw what was happening, and I was reading these comments like that Thursday night, you know, and one person in particular, it was Donnie Wahlberg. He kept texting me. He said, "You don't know what you're doing. You're saving lives right now." Those words resonated with me so deeply. So I decided to stay in LA to follow through with this, to make sure that I played music, to make sure that I was there. Let's go. Come on. My life is different. I have played places that, you know, normally you wouldn't see a DJ, you know, sold out Carnegie Hall twice and Kennedy Center sold that out three times. But especially in 2020 and early 2021, that space was so important, you know, to keeping people sane. Even myself, you know, there were times when I would walk away from the screen from DJing and I would have full on tears because a song made me emotional. And I always felt like I'm not alone in that, that there is someone on that other end that feels the same exact way, that's quarantined by themselves. Everything was so uncertain. We didn't know what we were facing, you know, but the one thing that we had was this little small community of people who loved music, but the music was secondary to what was actually happening there. And that was this connection for people. And it will forever be one of the most meaningful things that I've ever done in my life. One big party. One big party.
Did going through that experience of DJing when so much of the world was shut down and yet being able to bring people together, did that change the way you think about your role as a DJ, the work that you do, the music that you spend?
It changed the way, not necessarily about my role, because I've always felt prideful being a DJ, you know, it being in this business when you say, oh, you're a DJ, and I'm like, oh, you're the wedding DJ. And it's like someone has this kind of, you know, misconception about what you do. And I'm like, no, I'm actually music curator. You know, like that's who I am. I love music and I love to play music for people and change moods. And I've always felt the power of DJs was extremely important. But what it did for me was to be unafraid of playing what I truly love, to show people how much of these classic records still hit right now if you just play them the right way, you know? So now when I do my shows, if I throw a David Bowie record on, no one's gonna leave the dance floor because they're gonna trust me with the music.
All right, we like to ask our guests sometimes to take us out on a song. Is there a song that you associate with those early sort of pioneering days of club quarantine that we should go out on?
Yes, you should go out on a song that actually got me through that time. And every time I would play that song, it meant so much to me. So I want to go out with Sister Sledge song, Thinking of You.
I'm thinking of you and the things you do to me.
That is DJ D-Nice. Thanks for being here and for giving so many of us a way and a place to come together when we couldn't do so physically. Thank you.
Thank you.
This is NPR News. The state of Louisiana is locked in a legal battle over what would have been its first execution in 15 years. State officials plan to use nitrogen gas to execute Jesse Hoffman Jr. on March 18th for murder. But on Tuesday, a federal judge temporarily blocked the execution after Hoffman's lawyers argued the method of execution would violate his constitutional rights. And before we start, a warning, this piece does contain descriptions of what happens during executions. From the Gulf States newsroom, Kat Stromquist reports.
On the steps of an imposing brick synagogue in uptown New Orleans, about 40 people gathered to protest, pray, and sing. Many are members of the Jews Against Gassing Coalition, a group that formed last year in response to state efforts to add nitrogen gas to its execution methods. Naomi Yavnik-Close is one of their leaders.
You know, the idea that our state
would put people to death by this method that killed millions of our relatives. We felt that was a place to unite.
She says their members see using gas to kill as traumatic.
It really is very disquieting to have our concerns as a community that has suffered genocide, dismissed.
A federal judge this week temporarily halted Hoffman's execution, saying that nitrogen hypoxia poses, quote, a substantial risk of conscious terror and psychological pain. It deprives the body of oxygen. Louisiana is among states looking to new execution methods as it's faced challenges obtaining lethal injection drugs.
States around us are finding ways and methods in order to execute those that have been tried and convicted and sentenced to death.
That's Louisiana's Governor Jeff Landry at a news conference last year. He's led the push to resume executions after a pause of more than a decade. His office didn't respond to interview requests, but he has said the state aims to use the gas method and keep, quote, promises to victim families.
I've listened to those families from all over the state. They deserve their day of justice.
Only Alabama has used nitrogen gas to carry out 4 executions. It's a controversial method. Witnesses to the state's first gas execution said the person being executed stayed conscious for several minutes and was gasping for air and convulsing. University of Richmond law professor Corrine Elaine says it's not uncommon for states to set ways to execute people, hanging, the electric chair, then try something else.
And so when it becomes unacceptably barbaric, they have to move on because it begins to prompt questions about the death penalty itself.
Instead of nitrogen gas, Hoffman has asked to die by firing squad, but that's not an option in Louisiana. South Carolina put someone to death using the firing squad last week. Lane says these methods have something in common.
You know, both the firing squad and nitrogen gas are showing state violence. They are reminding Americans, no, this is what the death penalty is.
Louisiana plans to appeal the judge's ruling on Hoffman's execution as courts take a closer look at the gas method. For NPR News, I'm Kat Stromquist in New Orleans.
You're listening to All Things Considered from NPR News. We'll be right back.
From NPR News, this is All Things Considered. I'm Mary Louise Kelly.
And I'm Juana Summers. President Trump has been shopping for a Tesla this week, including sitting in a red Model S at the White House. He says he's buying a vehicle as a show of support for his advisor, Elon Musk. Tesla's sales have been dropping, and its stock price fell dramatically since the inauguration. Democrats are turning away from the brand. Could growing popularity among Republicans make up for it? NPR's Camila Domonoske reports.
You have probably heard about the protests at Tesla dealerships, the owners with buyer's remorse and apologetic bumper stickers, people calling Teslas swastikas. Suffice it to say, Musk's rightward turn has turned off a lot of would-be Tesla buyers. But of course, there are also a lot of people in this country who like what Elon Musk is doing. People like Kamali Wright. He works in marketing in Florida and spoke to me from inside his Model 3, which he's owned for several years.
Man, I've been a fan of Elon forever. After seeing him team up with Trump, to me, I was like, oh man, you know, this is like my two favorite people now.
Wright says the massive backlash against Musk makes him more inclined to buy a Tesla. He wants a Cybertruck next.
You know, if everybody's going to hate on this guy, that's going to make me buy even more, I guess.
There's also Norman Pienyanczyk. In the 80s, he was an underground publisher fighting censorship in Poland after the government imposed martial law. He moved to the U.S., and a few years ago, when his posts challenging the science about COVID were taken down on Facebook and Twitter, it felt like censorship all over again. Then Musk announced he wanted to buy Twitter and restore free speech.
So I said, okay, that's my guy.
Pienyanczyk needed a new car anyway. He was planning to get a gas-powered car, but...
If it's my guy, my heart is with him. I have to put my money where my heart is.
He bought a Model X in 2022. Now look, it's very unusual to buy a car to support a CEO, but it's very normal for car buyers to use their purchase to signal things about themselves. Once upon a time, driving a Tesla signaled you were tech-savvy, eco-conscious, just plain rich. Now, for many people, it shows support for Musk and Trump. And here's the problem for Tesla. Right now, there are simply not enough Wrights and Pienyanczyks to make up for all the people who are not buying Teslas because of Musk.
There are going to be no explosion of sales that recover the losses that Tesla has been enduring because of this political shift.
Alexander Edwards runs Strategic Insights, a company that surveys new car buyers. His data last year showed that for the first time, a new Tesla buyer was more likely to be a Republican than a Democrat. But that's not because Republican sales surged. It's because many Democrats were fleeing.
All they've done is alienate their primary consumer, and those that would love to buy them are not in a position to buy them.
That's not just ideological opposition to EVs. Republicans are more likely to live in areas with less charging infrastructure. Cities and areas with more progressive governments typically have more plugs available. Tesla and Musk did not respond to requests for comment, but Musk has previously said it's the quality of the product that matters, not a CEO's views. Jessica Caldwell is an analyst with Edmunds, the car data giant. She says Tesla is different than other car companies. Everyone has an opinion about the CEO. And that's a problem.
Why would you ever want to alienate potential buyers in general?
That said, Caldwell notes multiple reasons why Tesla sales are struggling right now. There's more competition. There's an updated Model Y coming, giving shoppers a reason to wait a few months. So you would expect that to pull down sales. There's also plenty of drivers who say their feelings about Musk have nothing to do with what's in their driveway. Like Nancy Baruti, a conservative Tesla driver.
I really don't let politics influence, you know, what kind of a product I like or the car that I buy.
But in general, politics can influence car sales, and that's especially true for EVs. Mike Murphy is a Republican strategist and EV enthusiast who has spent years pondering why more Republicans won't buy EVs. He argues that long before Musk's political turn, EVs were already politicized as symbols of green liberal values.
They're seen as political statements, not as cars, and that's not good for selling more electric vehicles.
He'd like to see EVs sold on their merits. The gas savings, the quick acceleration, the smooth and quiet ride, never changing oil again.
Take the politics out of it and let people with clear eyes pick the car that's best for them and choose the powertrain they like.
Right now, taking politics out of EVs isn't exactly happening. Murphy says what Musk is doing is a little bit like pouring gasoline on a battery fire. Camila Domonoske, NPR News.
Some might be able to tell that spring is in the air by the brighter afternoons and the shedding of all those heavy coats.
Others of us have already been alerted by itchy eyes, runny noses, and scratchy throats.
Yep, and if those annoying seasonal allergies feel like they've been intruding earlier and stronger, well, it may not be all in your head.
Lou Ziska is an associate professor at the Malman School for Public Health at Columbia University. He has studied how climate change has affected plant biology for more than 30 years.
As things start earlier in the spring and go longer in the fall, because of the warmer weather, that results in a longer pollen season.
How much longer depends on where you live. In general, the northern U.S. appears to be more affected.
In those areas, we're seeing a substantially longer growing season than we're seeing it in places that are in the southern U.S., sometimes by up to an additional 2 to 3 weeks.
And it's not just that pollen's around for longer, some is more potent.
The thing that makes pollen allergenic are the proteins on the surface of the pollen. And what we found was that the concentration of that particular pollen protein was increasing in the case of two plant species that we know are very allergenic. One is oak, and the other one is ragweed.
Another factor, carbon dioxide, something plants rely on to grow.
The increase in carbon dioxide concentration stimulates the plant to make more pollen, and it increases the amount of allergic proteins in the pollen itself.
That is Mary Margaret Johnson, principal research scientist at Harvard T.H. Chan School of Public Health. She says extreme weather events, from high winds and thunderstorms to droughts and fires, that they can also exacerbate allergies by spreading pollen farther and wreaking havoc on our respiratory systems.
And air pollution is yet another factor.
The pollen itself can attach to particulate matter, kind of acting like a hitchhiker. And so when you inhale the particulate matter, you may be getting more pollen.
Johnson says while people with pre-existing allergies will suffer more, there may also be some people experiencing pollen allergies for the first time.
So for newcomers and veterans alike, here's some tips from Johnson and Ziska to reduce your exposure.
If you take an antihistamine during pollen season, the recommendation is to start taking it like even 2 weeks earlier than you typically would.
If you have a HEPA filter or ways to try and purify the air in your house, that's also another good strategy to practice. Washing clothes can be good. Sometimes when you're outdoors, you get a lot of pollen on you, and that can stay with you when you go inside.
And of course, if possible, stay indoors on high pollen days, even though it might be kind of difficult to resist the lure of all those colorful flowers and the bright sun.
Thank you for listening to All Things Considered from NPR News.
Support for NPR comes from the station and from Moderna, committed to protecting people from COVID-19. The CDC recommends getting a second dose of this season's COVID-19 vaccine for those 65 and older. Doctors can advise about getting a second dose. From Workday. Workday is an HR and finance platform for forward thinkers, dedicated to propelling organizations, workforces, and industries into the future. Workday, moving business forever forward. From Subaru, the 2025 Subaru Outback features standard symmetrical all-wheel drive, including safety features like EyeSight Driver Assist technology. Learn more at Subaru.com/outback.